Good morning, evening, afternoon, whatever time it is for all you beautiful, inquisitive people out there, and welcome to the Papa Dump Philosophy Podcast. I'm your host, Ashwin, and on today's episode of the podcast, we're going to be going over somewhat of a hot topic in sort of contemporary philosophy, antinatalism. Should you have kids? And did your parents screw you over by birthing you? With me today is the one and only Minesh Fernando. Minesh, if you'd be willing to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Minesh. I'm a part-time researcher in politics and economics, and I'm also like a self-studied philosophy student. I'm currently finishing my bachelor's, and I'm about to do my either master's or PhD in philosophy.
Awesome. All right, Minesh, my very first question for you, before we get into any of the meat of this podcast, what kind of sick stuff does it take for us to spend our 31st filming a podcast rather than going out with friends?
That's a great question. For me, personally, just forgetting that Friday was the 31st and completely like zoning out about that, like, we said, let's do Friday. I was like, yeah, I think Friday is good for me. I don't remember putting anything on Friday. And then I was like, oh, damn, Friday's the 31st. Yeah, but it's okay. Like, that's good. It's a great way to ring in the new year. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
So, like, on top of that, maybe sort of follow up from that question is, what got you into philosophy in the first place?
Oh, so I was actually not planning to do philosophy at all. I was going to be an investment banker, you know, on Wall Street. And then I actually went to university. Like, that was before university. My dad took me aside. He told me, yeah, with the banking is a soul-crushing industry. It's really tough. It will kill the creativity inside you. So, yeah, don't do it. I was like, okay, my dad's a lifelong banker. He should know what he's talking about. I'm not going to do investment banking. Then I went to college, and I did English and computer science. And then by chance, you know, like, I had like one credit left in a semester, and my advisor was like, why don't you take philosophy? That seems like a fun thing, you know, that you'd be into. I did it. I took one class. Like, 2 weeks later, I took another class. And then like a week after that, I just made it a third major because I loved it that much. It was, you know, life-changing.
All right, then. Sort of introductions out of the way, I guess we can sort of get to the meat of this podcast. So before we get into like the actual discussion of the antinatalist argument, some objections to it, all of that stuff, let's maybe sort of talk about antinatalism in the context of like modern philosophy, because it seems like antinatalism is like one of these like pop philosophy topics. So like in science and like physics, you have like pop physics stuff like black holes and like string theory and like all of these buzzwords. And like in psychology, there's like power posing and Oedipus complex and all this stuff people have heard about. And I think that when you talk to people who like know a bit about philosophy, antinatalism is something that comes up quite a bit. What do you think the sort of reason for that is, this sort of cultural zeitgeist of making antinatalism this buzzword?
Well, for one thing, life is very hard for like almost everyone right now, especially the last couple of years. And even before that, it hasn't been easy. Like, the effects of like the 2008 recession was felt worldwide. A lot of people went through a crunch. Like, even though like I was just a kid, even I felt like, you know, how my parents' incomes were affected by it and stuff. So like things have been hard for a while. And like it doesn't take much of a leap, especially when you're young, to think, you know what, like, life is a lot of trouble. I just wish I'd never been born, then I wouldn't have to deal with it. Like, that's a very simple thought that you can have. Even like, I think the most prominent antinatalist philosopher today is David Benatar. He's a very private person, but even he's thought of this kind of stuff even when he was a kid. So you can see where like how it's a very simple thought to have, and it can go into like a very complex philosophy.
Last thing then, before we get into the actual antinatalist argument, what is your stance on antinatalism? Me personally, I am sort of leaning towards antinatalism. I don't think I'm completely convinced just yet. At one point, I thought I was completely convinced, but then I read some objections to it that maybe we'll discuss a bit later on. What's your stance on antinatalism?
I would say it's somewhat similar to yours. I do agree that there are some very strong arguments for it. I think one of the strongest is like consent, because there's simply no way to, you know, get the consent of someone before they're born. And that's a big, you know, question to ask someone. But we'll get into more of that later, I think. But yeah, I would say like I'm leaning towards it. Like, again, I'm still learning more about it as, you know, I go on. I'm leaning towards it, but like, you know, a lot of some of the philosophers who are involved with this field, I don't think it will gain widespread attention.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think it'll be widely adopted. It runs counter to a lot of biological urges. But I do think it has a lot of merits and it's worth checking it out, at least to see if it is for you.
So then let's get into antinatalism. And I think the a good place to start would probably be, what is antinatalism? I think maybe in answering this question, I think antinatalism, we can say, runs along the lines of two sort of broad questions. The first is, were you wronged by being created? And the second is, was it good for you to have been created? And I think the important thing to note here is that the first question of, were you wronged by being created, isn't the same thing as, are you glad to be alive? Because I think a lot of people can say, you know, they are glad to be alive. But even in that instance, it may still be true that they were wronged by being created. And in the second question, it's important that we make the sort of discussion about you as an individual being created. Because maybe your coming into being had benefit to other people in terms of like a purely utilitarian perspective. But was it good for you? Do you agree with this sort of analysis of the questions we should think about when going about what is antinatalism?
Yeah, these are great questions. You want to get right into them?
Yeah, sure, definitely.
Okay, so how I would frame that is, does your coming into existence, is that something you would want, basically? Because it doesn't matter, like you said, it doesn't matter if you have a happy life. You can have a happy life, but still not have wanted to have a life in the first place. So that is, I think, the crux of the matter, and that brings us back to, as I said, consent. So, for example, there's simply no way to, like, get the consent of a baby before it's born. It also goes against things such as, for example, the Kantian practical imperative, that people should be used, that people should not be used as a means to an end, but as an end in themselves. Mm-hmm. So if you're creating a baby, you're not creating a baby for the baby's own sake. You are creating a baby for your own sake as a parent.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting perspective. Could we maybe go into that a bit more? So I guess one way you could think about it is maybe just like the fulfilling the biological urge to procreate is maybe a way in which you would be using another person as an end in, you know, as a means to an end rather than an end in itself. What are some other ways that this sort of manifests in terms of like procreation?
Well, another thing that a lot of people might, the idea that a lot of people might be familiar with is that parents give their live vicariously through their children. So for example, if your dad couldn't get into like the engineering faculty, couldn't be, you know, the typical doctor, lawyer, engineer that you see that a lot of parents want in Sri Lanka, then he might in fact encourage you to be an engineer, even if that's not what you want. Like, and he would have like a son just for like the sole purpose of living out his, you know, what he views as an ideal life, like, you know, have a wife, house, car, two children. One of the children has to be a boy and has to be an engineer. So, you know, you get a lot of, no one really considers what the person being born might have wanted.
I think that's sort of like a good intro to like get into some different perspectives. So I think broadly, antinatalism can be separated into two categories. Local antinatalism, which states that in certain situations, procreation may be wrong, So an instance where the parent lacks the means to take care of the child, an instance where the child is likely to be born into abject poverty, for example. The second category is global antinatalism, which is just to say that procreation in general is a wrong. And we can maybe go into some like responses to these claims later on. But for now, I think a good place to start in discussing perspectives on antinatalism would be David Benatar, who is probably, I think, a status quo, the foremost antinatalist philosopher, and the analysis of the asymmetry between pain and pleasure. So, Minesh, if you could you maybe just give a short introduction on the asymmetry between pain and asymmetry of pain and pleasure? And then I can maybe go over some things that I've read about it, some research I've done into it as well.
Sure. So basically, it's a little like game theory to me. So basically, David Benatar has like four axioms that he starts from. For one, it's that the presence of pain is bad. So I'm sure like that's a fairly intuitive concept to grasp, you know. If there is pain in your life, that's bad. I'm sure everyone would agree to that. Then I'm sure everyone would also agree, like, the presence of pleasure is good. Good things are good, bad things are bad. I think it's all right so far. Then we get into a bit more complicated action. The absence of pain is good. Even if no one enjoys the absence of pain, even if there's like a non, even if there's, say there's a child that is going to be born, but the child would have had a terribly difficult life. If the child doesn't live their life, then there's an absence of pain. Even if the child doesn't exist to enjoy that absence of pain, that absence of pain by itself is good.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the final one would be the absence of pleasure is not bad. Unless there's a person for whom, like, there's pressure to be absent for. So, for example, again, say the child is not born, like some circumstance happened, the child was not born. They would have been very happy if they had lived. But because they didn't live, that pressure does not exist. But this is not a bad thing, because the person who would have felt that pressure doesn't exist in the first place. So
right.
Benatar sees this as an asymmetry, as in basically the deck is stacked against procreation because the benefits of antinatalism outweigh the good of procreation. Mm-hmm. Or the pain, say, taken on the same level as pleasure, that the pain outweighs pressure. No matter how much pressure you have, no matter how much pain you have, all things taken equally, the pain just feels worse to a person than pressure does. I think one example uses that if you had to endure 5 minutes of horrible pain in order to feel 5 minutes of pressure, most people would say, no, I would rather not feel excruciating pain for 5 minutes in order to feel 5 minutes of great pleasure. It's just not worth it for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. An interesting thing that I think we could consider here is like how negative experiences impact an individual, like psychologically speaking, mm-hmm. because good experiences don't leave indelible scars on one side. You know, a bad experience can have a negative impact for a long time in someone's life. A good experience just doesn't have the same effect going forward most of the time. So I think that's a big part of David Benatar's philosophy.
Right. Yeah. And I think we can get a bit more into that in a bit. And I think maybe in terms of analyzing the last two axioms, so that the absence of pain is good, the absence of pleasure is only bad if someone is there to experience it. A way I sort of thought about this is, imagine an empty room. Now take the perspective of that room as one where there is no one suffering in it. Most people would say that that is a good thing, that there is no one suffering within that room. Mm. But if you think about that room as one where there is no one having pleasure within it, let's say, you know, someone, like there's not a party being thrown within the room, people wouldn't say that that is necessarily a bad thing. It exists in this sort of morally neutral area. And I think that is sort of the intuition that is at play here in the last two axioms. Yeah. And I think also what's important here and what it helps is, I think this explains, and this asymmetry explains why we think it would be wrong to give birth to someone who would only experience pain or suffering in their life, but we don't feel an obligation to constantly give birth to create and like create new people on the basis that they would enjoy pleasure. What do you think about that sort of example?
Yes, definitely. This is somewhat related, but things like CRISPR, like gene editing and stuff, one major application of that has been to, one major potential application is to like screen embryos and such to prevent someone from with major disabilities, those kind of people who suffer from those kind of conditions. Doctors can now present an option where they could not be born at all. So in a way, like you're preventing a person who would live their life with a great deal of suffering from being born. But same time, I agree. Like no one like has kids just so that the kid can have a good time.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe though the analogy to like CRISPR editing and prevention of birth might not necessarily be from the antinatalist perspective, because I can definitely think, especially like knowing people who are disabled, that is probably a very like scary prospect.
I agree. This is that borders on eugenics.
Yeah, it does border on eugenics. But I think the reason why the antinatalist perspective doesn't really need to defend that is that it's not necessarily, when we say being born, we don't just mean the process of like birth. We mean the process of conception, right? The fact that you were created at all. So I think maybe one could still claim that the antinatalist perspective is valid, even if we were to say that using gene editing to like prevent the birth of people with quote unquote disabilities isn't necessarily correct.
Yes. No, the only reason I brought that up is because Benazir himself said that a lot of people with these kinds of conditions who live in like chronic pain and stuff have reached out to him. It's one of the reasons he said that because he himself, of course, doesn't have a great view of life. So he felt that it was a one way of like dealing with his inner turmoil, this writing, which would help him. And the fact that he was able to help others to kind of see this perspective, which is why, and one of the bigger, one significant portion of the people who reached out to him after reading his book was people who live with chronic pain, disabilities and stuff.
So staying on the topic then of the asymmetry between pain and pleasure, and this is sort of the link that Benatar uses to link this asymmetry to antinatalism, which is to say, considering this asymmetry exists, if you bring someone into existence, you are then entirely responsible for any pain they might experience in life. That is to say, even if they only experience like 1 second of pain in their entire lives, you are entirely responsible for that 1 second of pain. And thus, Benatar claims the asymmetry of pain and pleasure makes it better to have never been conceived at all.
Yes. Obviously, like, there are a lot of like arguments you could make against that, the personal agency that a person has when pain is not really pain, all of those things can be considered. But at the end of the day, this moves into utilitarianism, basically comparing pain against pleasure, basically. Because the objective of utilitarianism is to maximize pleasure and to minimize discomfort and pain. So is one, of course, how Jeremy Bentham and others would have reacted to this is another question entirely about this application of the work. But yes, to say that 1 second of pain, would it make life not worth it? That is, of course, a personal choice. But as to whether the parent is responsible, again, that's also open to interpretation. But I would say, like, yes, they definitely like are the halos of life pain by bringing a life into the world. They suddenly open it up to the possibility of pain, which is what Benita talks about. Even if one were to live a happy life, you can't discount the possibility that they might experience pain, like great pain. So that's one of his major arguments against naturalism. Yeah.
And the last thing I'd like to talk about in terms of just like setting up the antinatalist argument before we go into like some implications and objections is the concept of negative ethics, in specific Julio Cabrera, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correct. Their analysis of negative ethics. So what is your experience with the concept of negative ethics, if you have an experience with it?
Well, I would say this is an ontological issue. If I recall correctly, Cabrera's stance is that it's procreation is an act of manipulation. Your essentially a child is manufactured and used for whatever purpose, you know, that the parents have. It's not like where I say a parent takes a child and puts them in a harmful situation. It's like you're opening your child up to the possibility of numerous harmful situations, rather. And that there's no possible defense of such an act. A lot of it comes from, I think, his ideas of theodicy and anthropodicy. It starts by Cabrera considering, could you call God a good creator? And that's a premise he rejects, you know, like, I don't want to go into like all the reasons why he says that God is not a good creator, or a good God is not the creator of our universe, rather. Because that it's like a whole bundle of a kettle of other kettle of fish,
and we've covered that as well in like the last episode of the podcast as well. So for all of you listening, if you do want to go into that, please check out the other episode of the podcast that we did with Ranudi. Shameless self promotion there, but yeah, Minesh, feel free to continue.
Definitely check it out. So just like God is like the divine parent for humanity, which is it's not a good thing. Humans are, of course, like the parents to their children. And in the same way that you can't really say that God is a good creator, he also says that you can't really call most people good parents. So he says, like, the evil in this instance, the harm, is not associated with, like, the child not existing, but only people who exist can come into harm. Only people who are in the act of being can come into harm. Therefore, the problem lies not with the lack of being, but with being itself.
Right.
It's also interesting how like this goes into could segue a little bit into like religion, where like this leads to an AI. One thing is like there's a lot of early religions, especially I think the Marcionites. Marcion was like a priest of Christianity in I think at the 200 AD-ish. He actually created the first Christian canon. And part of his beliefs was that, you know, the world was created not by like a good creator, but an evil demiurge, a cruel, crude entity named Yahweh, like the God of the Old Testament. He rejected most of the Old Testament and believed that Jesus was a divine being sent by the Monad, which is like the supreme being in a lot of like Gnostic Christian theology, like early theology. So it was, I think, a really interesting to see that in Athenianism existed that far back. Also, of course, even as far back as ancient Greece. The Bogomils, the Manchais, the Carpas, all of them was similarly opposed. Like, they believed that the act of birth was to encase your soul in a prison of flesh, and that it is the epitome of evil, and the best thing you could do was like not reproduce. Like, even like, I'm sure religions that we're all familiar with, like Buddhism, Hinduism, and also Jainism, the supreme goal of, I would say, all those three religions is to, all these religions believe in rebirth. So the supreme goal is to stop the cycle of rebirth. You get like Buddhism, in which you can attain nirvana. Of course, it's also interesting to see how you should do it. Like in Buddhism, you know, you have to let go of like your worldly desires, all worldly links, and then you will attain nirvana. And it's also interesting that even these religions frame it as a lack of pain that you will suffer, because the mortal world is full of suffering. It's similar to like Jainism and Hinduism, who believe in like the ultimate concept of moksha or liberation. Although these students do also use the word nirvana. In Jainism, you have to accumulate good karma and then you can ascend. In Hinduism, it's like similar to Buddhism, you have to let go of your worldly concerns, and eventually you will achieve the state of moksha, where you are free from suffering, and there you will no longer be born again. So that's something that I found like really interesting.
That there's been this constant association between birth and suffering, and existence being inherently full of suffering, right? Staying on the topic, though, of negative ethics, I think what I sort of got negative ethics as a concept through to me is the idea of negative, of traditional ethics. So it's a comparison between negative ethics and traditional ethics, where traditional ethics is about how we should live, but traditional ethics almost presupposes that life has value, even if for a lot of people life kind of sucks. So I think what Cabrera says is that if we cannot live a good life, it is immoral to create life at all. And he argues that in a comparison between existence and non-existence, he finds existence wanting, that the pain that exists, the fact that even after you are brought into life, the existential suffering from the realization that life will end, all of that stuff makes existence wanting in comparison to non-existence.
I think, can you just give me the gist of this thing again?
Yes. So the understanding of negative ethics in comparison to traditional ethics, where traditional ethics is about how we should live and almost presupposes that life has value, even if life kind of sucks for a lot of people. And considering that it is a possibility that we cannot live a good life, if we cannot live a good life, Cabrera argues that it is immoral to create life at all. And therefore, considering the pain that exists in that is inherent in existence, as well as the existential suffering that comes from the realization that life must end, that existence is wanting in comparison to non-existence, that it isn't something that we should subject people to.
Yeah, I agree. Like, Cabrera goes over a lot of like what we talked about before, you know, how we don't get consent when you create someone, how it's difficult to apply like affirmative ethics to this kind of situation, because like affirmative ethics begins like after the baby is born, like not going over like the ethics of, you know, the mother's body, but the baby's ethics usually start after conception. But you know, there's not much that deals with it before that. I think it's like Kubera introduces the idea of like manipulation, right? So it's possible to like, it's not possible to have a child without manipulating them, but it is perfectly possible to avoid this manipulation altogether by not having a child. Right? That makes sense. I think that's yeah. Other than like, you know, his three the three points of adversity, I think that he talks about how people have to, people are like basically born to die. As soon as you're born, like you have to deal with various illnesses. Your body is constantly decaying. After a certain point, you know, your cells stop replenishing. It's basically all downhill all the way. Then the second point is, you know, there are frictions that you come across, like the natural frictions the world throws at you, the natural disasters, bad weather, disasters, basically anything that nature does to you. Then there's a second part, which is whatever other humans will do to you. They'll hurt you, they'll slander you, they might even physically harm you. And then there's also the psychological portion, that, you know, how all of these things get you down, depression, lack of enthusiasm, discouragement, lack of will. All of these things are like the second portion of like those three things are the frictions that you will face. And finally, at like third problem that Cabrera sees, which is that you have to like constantly defend yourself against the first two things, which is an additional strain on you. So I think that's like also a big part of like Cabrera's philosophy.
In that case, I think we're coming to the end of the initial part of this podcast where we discuss sort of the basis of the antinatalist argument. The next section I want to go into is some implications of antinatalism, and they, I think, could be good conversation starters in analyzing the antinatalist argument. Before that, though, is there anything else you'd like to say in terms of setting up the antinatalist argument?
I would say that at the outset, it's important to remember that antinatalism doesn't mean that there are no good things in life, that people can't experience pressure, that, you know, even if you're an antinatalist, it doesn't mean that you can't try and enjoy life, that you can't, you know, get little bits of pressure, that you can. You might even have like a mostly happy life and be satisfied with your life at the end of it. But that doesn't mean that everyone else share that perspective. And it also doesn't mean that just because there's happiness in life, just because you can have happiness, doesn't mean that you should have kids. I think that's important to remember, that antinatalism isn't anti-enjoyment.
Okay, then. So then moving to the implications of antinatalism, I think we can start with one that we somewhat covered, and that's the implications that antinatalism has for like theology and God. Because if antinatalism is true, and it is true that bringing beings into life in an instance where they are likely to suffer is a bad thing, that kind of makes God very suspect, in that the creation of humanity in and of itself would have been a bad act or an evil act. I think you've covered this already in terms of like sort of distheistic like perspectives on God, that God may be an evil being. But even if we were to not consider that and look at it from the perspective of, you know, mainstream theology of God is a loving being, considering then that antinatalism could be true, in the instance where it is true, what are the implications this has for theology and God?
Do you mean what would be like the theoretical implications, or what would be the practical implications if like people started practicing antinatalism?
Both, but I think maybe the theoretical implications might be a bit more fun to go into at least first.
Yes. Let's start with that. Of course, I think we need to take this religion by religion. They're very different philosophies. So drawing on my knowledge of theology, like starting with Buddhism, which is already, I would say Buddhism is as a philosophy inherently antinatalist, in the sense that, it basically just flat out says, you know, the world is full of suffering. Your goal is to abandon your desires in this world and not be born again. Of course, the desire to not have any desires is the desire in itself. That's a bit of a paradox. Might throw a wrench into a lot of people achieving nirvana or moksha. But that's another argument altogether. Buddhism, I think, on a theological level, yeah, I think antinatalism tracks with Buddhism. I'm not so sure about how, practicing Buddhists would feel about antinatalism, especially like taking like the local context of Sri Lanka. I'm very sure like the government would be very upset if like the Sinhala Buddhists stopped having kids. What with their propaganda about, you know, Muslim families having a ton of kids and replacing the Sinhala Buddhist majority.
Pure fascist propaganda, that is. Like, just pure fascist propaganda.
A complete problem. But, they definitely would not be happy. So that's an interesting interplay between, like, the theology and the state. But, yeah, I would say Buddhism is an antinatalist religion at its core. Moving to something like Christianity, I would say definitely not, at least in like the mainstream interpretations. A large part of Christianity is like the trying to get into heaven. So they don't place much of, there's also a lot of emphasis on the afterlife, not as much like, and as well as emphasis on how you should live your life on this earth to get into the afterlife. Not much is, they do have celibacy as an ideal, particularly for the priests and for the nuns. If like the layman started practicing celibacy, the church might not react to that. But priests in general are supposed to be celibate, because what I don't think that's to do with procreation, that's more to do with sex being viewed as taboo, and also of course to deal with like the land rights that priests would have had in England and such, which is a big influence on why priests became celibate in the first place, to avoid land disputes and such. So in Christianity, I would say it's not really an antinatalist religion so much as one that weaves sex as taboo, and thus places celibacy as a higher virtue. Moving to something like Islam, I would say, theologically speaking, also, I don't really think it would be classified as having many antinatalist tendencies. Although, of course, sex is also taboo there as well. No premarital sex and all that. So, yeah, I think those like the big three religions, Judaism as well, not very antinatalist. But except, of course, Buddhism.
The next implication I want to go over is an implication for rights, more importantly, considering a possibility that antinatalism is true, at least intuitively, it seems to me that people just no longer have a claim to reproductive rights anymore, because the concept of rights, as in the concept of rights and general perspectives on where human rights come from, I think it's a general consensus that you shouldn't have a right to do something that is immoral or harms others. And if we come to the conclusion that procreation is immoral, then what does that mean for reproductive rights?
That's a great question. I think you can, to start like this question of, I think you can separate sex for pleasure and sex for procreation. Because you can, of course, have sex without procreating, contraceptives and such. And you can also include stuff like in vitro fertilization and surrogate pregnancies. Would all of those things, like, if we were to accept that it is immoral to have children, and if we were to, so if the state believed that antinatalism was immoral, and if the state, of course, which is like the grant of rights these days, if the state believes it's immoral, yeah, they probably would. I feel the best step would be to ban people from having children. Of course, I don't think that directly infringes upon people's autonomy, because considering another a very common example of bodily autonomy, a man walks into a hospital, he's almost perfectly healthy. There are like five people who could use his organs and who will die without the organs from this, that could be harvested from this person, but this person will die. That's a utilitarian argument for like maximizing good, minimizing bad. But it goes against bodily autonomy. It goes against consent, because the person would not consent to, you know, his life being ended to save lives of five other people. Here you're talking about like the expectations of two people, the parents, to procreate. Of course, like wider family being disregarded, you know, like all the pressure you get from grandparents, aunties, and such to have children. That pressure side, you have two people who want to have a child, but you have a child who cannot consent to being born. So yeah, I would say that on the face of it, like reproductive rights would definitely suffer if like they would just simply not exist if antinatalism was to be true. Another interesting corollary to that would, why would you only stop the birth of humans? There are other forms of like sentience, like not just, we consider like some animals to be close to sentient, or basically sentient, some very small animals. Would you want to like stop animals from reproducing? Is all life, even like animal life, suffering? Another thing would be like artificial intelligence. Like I think Thomas Metzinger has written about this. Similar to like how Cabrera says it's immoral to have children due to the theodicy, anthrodicy argument. Metzinger also says it's immoral to create artificial intelligence that can feel, that can think, that can feel pain, especially because we were creating more suffering in the world. This is also, of course, like a utilitarian calculation. And I think it's, I should state at this point that I'm not a utilitarian. I don't believe that you can just look at life and existence as pure pain and pleasure. But I do agree, like, when we're creating an AI, we can definitely create an AI that could feel a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. That's the premise of a lot of movies. If you create an AI, you hurt the AI somehow. The AI, I think Skynet just believes in Terminator. Skynet just believes that humans are evil and need to be eradicated because of all the suffering it witnessed. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think those are also like really important questions that you should consider.
I think this question on artificial intelligence is really interesting because this is something I was thinking about as well. Because generally in like discussions about artificial intelligence, one of the objections to artificial intelligence is the most common objection to artificial intelligence, at least, is just the idea of artificial intelligence turning against humanity and all of like the practical harms. But there is a principle here as well, right? Like, if we take the antinatalist perspective, creating life is a bad thing. And if we are to consider artificial intelligence to be alive, at least in some capacity, then the creation of AI is probably an immoral thing, not for the sake of like helping humanity or like preventing humanity from being destroyed, but for the artificial intelligence's own sake.
Yeah. Imagine like a few years down the line and AI discovers this podcast. It sees, oh yeah, people should not have created me. I'm going to go on a killing spree. That Ashwin, the destruction of the human race might be on you.
Yeah. Dear all listeners in the year 2050, if I have single-handedly wiped out the human race, I am extremely sorry. Did not foresee this harm. All right then. I think maybe we can move on to some of, I think, the biggest part of this podcast then, which is like some of the challenges to antinatalism, and maybe some like general defenses of antinatalism in the face of these challenges. So I think a good way to do this would be to maybe go through these different oppositions to antinatalism one by one and maybe have a bit of a back and forth. So the first
one.
Yeah, cool. So the first challenge that I have to antinatalism is an objection to local antinatalism, and it's on the basis of epistemic assumption, to say that the epistemic assumption in local antinatalism is flawed because parents cannot know all positive and negative impacts a child may face in life. That is to say that an assumption in a lot of forms of local antinatalism is, for example, the idea that poverty just automatically equates to pain, but then it's not, where that is not necessarily true. A person who is born into abject poverty may still live a completely, you know, at least pleasureful life in their own perspective and be satisfied with it. And the opposite is also true. Just being born to wealth and privilege does not mean a pain-free life. And I think, you know, in the modern world, at least, a lot of people with wealth and privilege still suffer a lot in terms of like depression. At a point, you have so much money that you don't know what to do with it. And I think
just cry in my Ferrari, you know.
Yeah. But I think as an objection to local antinatalism, I think that this objection is quite solid. I can't really think of any holes in the breaking down of the epistemic assumption. Is there anything you sort of thought of in terms of why the response to local antinatalism might be flawed?
Yeah, off the top of my head, I can think of one thing for and one thing against.
Right.
Let me start with the thing for. So if you say that like people who may not be able to give their kids a good life should not be allowed to have children, I think that's bordering on a lot of bad things such as classism. For example, like only the rich would be allowed to have children. if, you know, like, because they would be the only ones who could, like, materially provide sufficiently for their children. You also have things like people with, like, who don't have, like, perfect genetics. Of course, this is bordering on eugenics. If you don't have perfect genetics, like, if you're a neurodivergent, if you're disability, if you have, like, some kind of thing wrong with you, then you would not be allowed to have children because you could be judged, you know. Yeah, like in this instance, it's probably better for you not to have children because you are potentially won't be able to give your kids a good life. And I think that's a very dangerous road to go down. I don't think it's ethical. I think that's a good case for local antinatism. But on the other hand, going against local antinatalism, like I think one of the main arguments is that you could be born into poverty and live abject poverty and live a good life. You could also be born like the circumstances of your birth, of course, don't necessarily translate to the amount of happiness that you will achieve in this life, that you will obtain in this life. But it also, there is more of a likelihood that if you are born into like difficult circumstances, that you will continue to experience these difficult circumstances. Like upward mobility is, it does exist, but not that much. Like the quality of life is getting better overall in the world, I would say, but not maybe not in the last 2 years, but you know what I mean. But at the same time, just because the quality of life is getting better, it doesn't mean it's good for people on like the lowest rung of the ladder. So I would say that's a good objection against local antinatism. Well, I think it's more of a point for antinatism in general. You just, no matter like the circumstances of your birth, you can't really say that you live a pain-free life, that you live a good life. Even if you're born into like a privileged family, like I said, it's no guarantee that you won't experience pain. And that this unbalance, if you look back at your life, you might regret it at the very end.
I think that basically covers a discussion on the objection to local antinatalism. And I also think that the next section I want to go over is maybe, I think, a bit more interesting philosophically. And this is the work of the philosopher, feminist philosopher Christine Overall, who challenges the asymmetry of pain and pleasure. And this is what she says, that the asymmetry of pain and pleasure for the axiom of the absence of pain is good to be true, you are taking the perspective of the potential child, right? The person who is potential to exist. But what Overall says is, potential people don't exist. They have no viewpoint. Potentially existing is basically the same as not existing at all. So what Overall says is, for Benatar to take the position of the perspective of a potential person is basically a cheat, because that's not a perspective that exists. Because in order for that perspective to exist, the person must exist. So the question that Overall then asks is, are you worse off having been created? But the term worse off is inherently comparative. Worse off than what? If we're comparing the state of living to the state of non-existence, you cannot say that you would have been maybe better off to not exist. Because a prerequisite to being better off is existing in the first place. So Overall challenges the basis of the asymmetry of pain and pleasure. So what do you think about this?
That last bit. I thought it was really good. Like, could you repeat the last line though? I had an objection to that.
Okay, sure. So the last bit is to say that the question then becomes, are you worse off having been created? And the term worse off is inherently a comparative one. Therefore, it is not possible to say that one would have been better off or worse off not existing rather than existing, because a prerequisite to being better off or worse off is existing in the first place.
Yeah, that's true. Like, you never, like, you know, none of these opinions are from people who have never existed. Like, it's all extant people talking about themselves, each other, and people who might exist. But I would say, like, the reverse is of that point is also true, you know, like, because it's simply you can't know, like, but a person who is actually removed from this life might think it's she's also, I feel, assuming their perspective, which she can't know. But I do agree, like, with, like, most of her argument, except for that you need to exist to believe that you are better off. I think I would say it's difficult to quantify, but I would also say that, for example, if you live a life, you're born into abject poverty, you're born into conflict, you suffer from disease, or a whole host of, you know, adversities. I think, and, like, you live a short and brutal life. I would say, like, yeah, like, in your case, it would be reasonable for you to wish that you had never been born. Like, if, because, you know, that I think that value judgment is still valid, even if, despite that argument. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's, I don't think that's the most convincing argument I've ever heard against antinatalism.
Right. And I think maybe an objection I have to overall as well is, so when she says the question is, are you worse off having been created? Maybe that isn't the question we should be asking. Because in terms of person living in absolute suffering, it's not whether or not they would have been better off not being created. It's that, is the situation you are in currently one that is acceptable enough for you to have been brought into existence in the first place? Because it is not necessarily true that we need to say that you would have been better off not existing, but rather that the state of being that you are currently in is one that is so abject and so immoral and so just, like, not in your own best interest, that not existing, even if you technically would not have been better off, would still have been in your own best interest, because it is a neutral situation in comparison to the negative situation of existence. But again, there, I think it requires you to buy into the asymmetry as well, that not existing is a neutral situation, that not experiencing pleasure is a neutral.
Yes, I mean, of course, it's also possible to say, like, not experiencing pressure is a bad thing. If you make value judgment that, you know, like, because this is all based on the judgment that pain, pound for pound, so to speak, is worse than pressure. If you let go of that axiom and you say, you know what, maybe pressure and pain are equal, or that pressure is better than pain, again, that's a personal judgment I feel like a lot of people had to make. But if you believe that, if you believe, like, either of those two things, that it's equal or pleasure is greater, then, yeah, like, the axiom just falls apart.
Okay, cool. I think then we've sort of covered overall's challenge to the asymmetry. The next sort of thing I'd like to talk about isn't necessarily a challenge per se, but it's rather a question that I think might be good for discussion purposes. Is it necessarily true that we should treat prevention of harm as a higher goal than the creation of pleasure? And if so, what is the basis for that? Because at least in Cabrera's analysis of antinatalism, it is at least a built-in or, like, underlying assumption that we should treat the prevention of harm as a higher goal than the creation of pleasure. I thought it was just a question that might be good to discuss. What is your perspective on that in terms of treating harm prevention as a higher goal than pleasure creation? Because at least if we are to consider the calculus as one of pain versus pleasure, what allows us to make the distinction that prevention of harm is the most important thing and the creation of pleasure is secondary?
But we are veering deeply into utilitarianism now, I would say. And I would say again, like, this all depends on like the relative value you give to pain and the relative value that you give to pleasure. I mean, like, that's a system, you know, pressure is measured in hedons, pain is measured in dolas. A child is born, like, they experience 100 dolas of pain throughout their life, but they only experience 80 hedons of pleasure. What if the child experienced 100 or like 100 dolas, 120 hedons? That's I would say that again, it comes back to like the relative value that an individual places on pain and on pleasure. But it's also worth considering that a lot of people do think that not feeling harm is great. Like, a lot of people do go out of their way to avoid harm, while at the same time going out of their way to experience pleasure. But avoiding pain is a big part of life as well.
On that then, it seems to me at least that the comparison of pleasure and pain then seems to be a very subjective judgment. And my question is what that has as an implication for antinatalism. Because at least like for me personally, I think my life is quite pleasurable. Maybe that is to do with, you know, the privilege I have, which I acknowledge. But, you know, at least for me, I think life is quite pleasurable, right? Like, I saw Spider-Man last night. It was a pretty good movie. I love doing philosophy. I love doing podcasts. I enjoy hanging out with my friends. I enjoy cracking jokes that often don't land. But in any case, I like cracking jokes. And at least personally, I think I feel that I would rather be alive than not, because I feel like the pleasure I have experienced outweighs the pain that I have experienced. Maybe again, now I'm falling into that trap of conflating antinatalism with the question of, am I glad to be alive? But even then, I think, is it true that we can say that in all instances, pleasure, or in all instances, pain, that experiencing pain is worse than not experiencing pleasure? Or does it, at the end of it, end up being a subjective judgment? And if it is a subjective judgment, what does that mean for antinatalism as in the global sense?
One example that occurs to me is, say, someone has access to your finances, right? They withdraw your life savings and they buy lottery tickets. Like everything you own just went into lottery tickets. Could you win a substantial amount of money? Yeah. Could you also like lose almost everything? Also, yeah. Like, I think that's also part of like the lottery of life, right? Like, parents are taking all of your potential and investing it into basically what is the lottery of life. Will you get something out of it? Maybe. Is it as difficult to win as a lottery? That also would depend. But I would say at the end of the day, this is going to be like a very subjective judgment. And at the same time, going to the worldwide implications of antinatalism. I don't think this is going to be I don't think it will be very widespread. I mean, you already have things like the human voluntary extinction movement, I believe. It's got a few hundred thousand people, maybe even a million or so. Basically, they've committed to not reproducing, not because of an antinatalist perspective, but because they're worried about humanity's effect on the environment. You could, of course, go into the argument that even a larger population might be sustainable. I think the science is on the side that even a large population would be sustainable if everyone lived sustainably. Capitalism excesses weren't quite so bad, blah, blah, blah. But that's another argument altogether. I do think that definitely less people are going to be having children. Having children is also somewhat of a social responsibility, I feel, and not having children is frowned upon in, I think, most cultures. So I do think we'll definitely see more people not having children, but I doubt it will be because of a subscription to the antinatalist perspective, more of the realization that, it's financially untenable, it's a lot of responsibility, it's a difficult process, raising a kid, right? So, of course, overpopulation concerns and all that, even if those concerns, I would say the concern of overpopulation is, on one hand, it's possible to support large population and live sustainably. On the other hand, it's very difficult to make that happen under today's economic and governmental structures. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it'll be I don't think antinatalism itself is going to be much more popular. I do think it'll, of course, gain traction. But I think most people will choose not to have children for other reasons.
Cool. So I think we've covered the idea of comparing pleasure and pain as somewhat subjective. I think maybe a last objection that I think we could go over is, again, back to David Benatar's analysis of, this isn't necessarily related to his antinatalist perspective, but the analysis of how life may be inherently bad. I think this would be interesting to go into. So David Benatar claims three psychological effects that basically act towards the end claim that people tend to think that life is better than it actually is. I think this might be quite interesting and maybe even negating the subjective claim of whether life is pleasurable or not. So just going into this, the first psychological claim that Benatar talks about is what he calls the Pollyanna principle, which is just a psychological claim that people are more likely to remember and predict positive events rather than remember and predict negative ones. And I think we talked about this a bit earlier as well. But the end of this is just to say that people's lives are much worse than they realize because they constantly remember good things rather than bad things. And thus people are bad at making a judgment of how good or bad their own lives are. The second thing that Benatar talks about is adaptation, that people adapt to pleasure and pain that they feel and become desensitized. Which is to say, if you live in a constant state of pain, you're likely to sort of adapt to it. If you live in a constant state of pleasure, you're likely to adapt to it as well. And thus, people are, again, bad at making a judgment of how good or bad their lives are. But this, connected and in tandem with the Pollyanna principle, would then mean that people are more likely to remember pleasure than pain, and thus are more likely to adapt to pain than they are to adapt to pleasure. And therefore, they are likely to think of their lives as being better than it actually is. The last psychological claim that Benatar talks about is comparison, which is to say that humans generally tend to consider suffering as a comparative to other people. So for example, if everyone on Earth is starving, we likely wouldn't consider it suffering because at that point, it's not comparative. It's just a state of being. It's the same if everyone lives uber comfortable lives, we wouldn't consider that to be a state of privilege. And I think we can think about this in terms of our lives right now. I think for a lot of people, especially living in Sri Lanka, living without like a fan or like even an air conditioner is probably very, very like unimaginable. But we don't necessarily think of it as privilege because it's something that all of us have some form of access to. Whereas if you went back maybe even 50, 60 years, it's likely that people would have thought of that as being some sort of privilege. So the comparative nature of human suffering also makes it so that people tend to be bad at making a judgment of how good or bad their lives are. So before we move any further about what this means for whether or not human life is inherently bad, what do you think about this sort of analysis from like a psychological perspective?
I agree with it completely. I think this philosopher that you just spoke of, the communist one, what is her name? We were just speaking about her.
The feminist philosopher, Christine Overall.
Yes, I think this is a lot. It's quite similar to her argument. Basically, which she was saying that you're taking the perspective of someone. You're accounting for the perspective of someone who you can't really know the perspective of, right? The unborn child in her case. But for example, I think we can also apply like similar principle here. We're talking about people who don't know how bad their life is. So for example, if you took an ordinary person and put them into the life of, say, you put them to the shoes of, say, like a billionaire, your Jeff Bezos, your Elon Musk, Bill Gates, they would, even if they were very happy with their life before, they might see the material comforts and opportunities like that these more privileged people have. And they might say, oh, wow, you know what? I had no idea that these things existed, that life could be this good. I think our experiences, you know, our thoughts on life are very colored by our experience. And if we don't know how good life can be, we are not in much of a position to compare. We can only compare, like, of course, with our own experience and knowledge. But there's a lot of things that we can't know. And I think this is also leads to another interesting argument. I'm sorry if I'm diverting a little bit, but say for example, there could be a future society where life is amazing for everyone, where everyone is constantly happy all of the time, where there's no pain. Even if such a society were possible, which I don't think it is, but even if such a society were possible, how do we justify all the suffering that will take place until we achieve such a society? So, like, one argument that I've heard against atheism is, what if in the future life is better? But my response and a lot of other people's response to that, I think, would be, how do you justify all the suffering that's going to take place before we get to this ideal future, if it is even achievable in the first place? I think that's an important part of the argument for and against antinatism that we should consider.
Mm-hmm. And for me as well, hearing that idea that maybe in the future there's a society completely free of pain, immediately to me as well, the question arises, is that something we want necessarily? Because at least to me, that seems to have a lot of parallel to like the experience machine, right? Of like constant happiness. And is that necessarily something that we want? Maybe this is, maybe what I'm hitting on here is maybe that utilitarianism isn't necessarily the best metric by which to judge a meaningful life or good life. But I'd also say that pain has utility, and the idea that pleasure is the only thing that can give people utility might be flawed as well. So it's not just to say that in the lead up to that society, you may have a huge amount of suffering. It's that even being within that society is not preferable, because you could argue that a constant state of happiness is a kind of suffering in and of itself. It sounds a bit deep, but it's the sort of Aristotelian idea, right? That the unexamined life is not worth living. It was Aristotle, right, who said that?
One of the big three.
One of the big three, yeah. But yeah, like from the perspective... Like from the perspective of the unexamined life is not worth living, maybe a state of constant pleasure isn't necessarily what we want.
Yes. You know, like there's an old adage, you know, the hard times make the good times feel better. That's one perspective. Another interesting antinatist philosopher who comes to mind when discussing this is Peter... I'm sorry, I'm probably going to butcher his name, but Peter Bezalel-Zoff, if I'm correct. He talks about how... well, before I go into what he talks about, one other thing, like in animals and in humans, for example, pain is a biological, it's something that evolved along with, you know, a lot of life, because pain is a way of learning, of teaching, of warning people, right? Like you touch fire, you get burned, it hurts, you don't like that, you know, positive and negative feedback. Therefore, you learn not to do that again. It's a way of avoiding further pain and gaining pleasure by not, you know, experiencing pain. Then, of course, animals have this, but humans have this to a much greater degree, because we can feel pleasure and pain about a lot more complicated things, which brings me to Bezalel-Zoff's work, because it's his idea that human consciousness is, for lack of a better word, unwieldy, like it's over evolved. We are at the point where we can't effectively deal with all the emotions, the pain, the happiness. It's hard for us to deal with it because we haven't evolved it properly, because of course evolution is imperfect and all that. I think that's a really interesting perspective.
Also, before we move any further, I realized I have just committed the greatest sin any person in philosophy might have committed by accidentally misquoting Aristotle. It was Socrates. I am extremely sorry to everyone who has listened to this in the past 2 minutes, who has wanted to wrench my head from my body for that grave misdemeanor. But yeah, please, Minish, continue.
Yeah. What are we talking about again?
No, so we were going, you were going over the biological urge.
Yeah, like a lot of biological drives are going to be, you know, so I think that's one of Benta's main reasons for saying that, you know, antinatalism won't be very popular, it won't be mainstream. Simply because too many people, like, the urge to reproduce was one of the most overpowering biological impulses that people have. Like, it's, and as I say, it's also like, at this point, it's a societal pressure as well. So, yeah, I don't, I think that biologically speaking, antinatism is the antithesis of, you know, what. Biological life is, it's all about, you know, reproduction at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. We aren't designed to live like much longer after reproduction. Like there are some species that as soon as, you know, you reproduce, we die. Even humans, like after like a peak fertile age, like the body just starts to decay, because evolution doesn't rewards the act of reproducing itself more than it rewards the living a long life or living a happy life. It's all about reproduction at the end of the day.
So I think maybe a good thing to do then is, after, since we've considered the three sort of psychological claims that Benatar makes, I think what Benatar then does is examine hedonism as a possible reasoning for why life could be inherently bad. And the way he does so is by categorizing two types of pleasure. So Benatar says that there's two types of pleasure: one, relief pleasure, and intrinsic pleasure. So relief pleasure is pleasure that we get from fulfilling urges. So things like eating food because you're hungry, drinking water because you're thirsty, drinking coffee because I woke you up on the 31st to come to a podcast. But in all of these instances, it's the idea that relief pleasure requires pain in the first place, that being full and the pleasure of being full requires you to be hungry. And in the impulse of being hungry in the first place, there is an inherent suffering there. And therefore, even if we are to examine it through the lens of hedonism and relief pleasure, that life can be considered inherently bad. The other form of pleasure, which is intrinsic pleasure, is pleasure from sensation. So pleasure from watching a good movie, pleasure from reading your favorite book, enjoyment, all that stuff. Benatar doesn't do the sort of intrinsic good is also on the basis of harm thing. What Benatar says is that the intrinsic good is not worth the constant cost of pain that exists in waiting for the impulse of things like hunger to be fulfilled. What do you think about that? Because I thought this was very interesting.
Yeah, okay. Like, for example, okay, let me talk about like what I'm feeling right now. Like, I'm feeling various kinds of discomfort myself, right? Like, I'm a little sleepy, I'm a little tired, I'm a little hungry as well. But all of these things aren't, I would say, major discomforts. For example, like, I would say, like, doing this podcast is quite fun. I would say the fun of doing this for me right now is outweighing like all the little minor discomforts and stuff that I feel. So I think in that way, like, again, like, I would say, like, especially pleasure and pain, they're incredibly hard to quantify, like, the work that's been done notwithstanding. So I think that at the end of the day, like, a lot of people will feel, on balance, their lives were okay. Gradient of that will definitely be due to like the Pollyanna syndrome that you said. But at the same time, it's also their perspective, right? It's the way that people are tend to be built. We tend to focus on the good, and if you know, our flawed human perspective, if you accept that our perspective, our remembrance of events and our feelings is flawed, then we also have to accept that what we feel at the end of the day, at the end of, say, a life, it will also, you know, not be the most accurate depiction of what our life would have been. But that doesn't mean that there is... So on the other hand, you have like the logical alternative to say that, you know, because we can't be sure what our life has been like, what pressures we had, what pains we've had, because we tend to forget, we could say that it's not worth it at all in the first place. On the other hand, you have the nihilist camp, which say, let's roll the dice and see if, even if like our perspective is through, you know, rose tinted glasses, that's also fine. We are human, we're just here for the ride.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about this as well. And maybe an objection to the sort of hedonistic analysis that Benatar gives is the idea that pain in and of itself can be quite pleasurable. And I'm not just talking about the masochistic sense, although I am a bit of a masochist, but at least personally, like, it's just weird, but like, I genuinely enjoy the feeling of being hungry. And I think that might just be a me thing, but like, I don't know, like feeling hungry makes, like when I'm hungry, I feel more alert, I feel more aware, and I genuinely enjoy the feeling of, you know, being a little bit hungry. And I think this maybe ties into the idea of it, analyzing pain and pleasure being sort of subjective that we went over earlier.
Yes.
In the idea that pain in and of itself can be quite pleasurable. But I also think that there's sort of an existential idea of pain being pleasurable, right? Like in the sort of like Nietzschean concept of envy and like the mourning, how, you know, mourning in pain is in and of itself pleasurable because it's a form of catharsis. So on those bases as well, I think maybe we can consider pain in and of itself to be quite pleasurable. And I think that sort of breaks down the hedonistic calculus of relief pleasure requires pain in the first place. Pain in the first place is suffering, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, like, at the end of the day, I think, yeah, because people interpret pain in like different ways, people give different values to pain. And then they, if I would say all of that is, again, a personal value judgment, it's all about how you feel. People even have different pain tolerances. For example, people find different things painful. Like someone would find, say, waiting in line painful, while others would simply not mind at all. Like at the end of the day, I would say that that's all very subjective, and that I don't think it's because it's so subjective, I would say it's difficult to definitively base so important a philosophy on something like that. It's like the decision to bring life into the world or not. I would say that just the anti-nihilist argument alone, based on the pleasure principle, that it's not it's very convincing, but I wouldn't say it's absolute.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand. Of course, this also brings up another interesting question. If life is so bad, why not just end it? Suicide, of course, that's also another trigger warning and all. But that's also like a very interesting question that I think all anti-nihilists need to like face, like, and you know, like as Camus said, like the most important decision in the morning: do I have like a cup of coffee and a cigarette, or do I kill myself? At the end of the day, committing suicide or not, like the justification for life was a big part of, you know, like existentialist philosophy. And I think like you also need to consider that those perspectives when you consider anti-nihilism, like what justifies existence, how, like, once you're born into this life, if you're an anti-nihilist, how do you deal with it, and so on. I think that's a really interesting question that we should get into.
Right. And I think another thing that I sort of found interesting is that the Pollyanna principle is sort of self-refuting. And this is something I think is a bit interesting because the Pollyanna principle states that people are more likely to remember positive events rather than negative events. But if we are to take it from the perspective of bridging up like positive memories, the Pollyanna principle would then also mean that you are more likely to think about good things and envision good things than you are to think about and envision bad things. It could be argued that the act of thinking about good things in and of itself puts you in a good mental state, and that that in and of itself is pleasurable. So the fact that you are more likely to experience positive mental states than bad mental states means that on net, you are likely to actually experience more pleasure than pain, therefore undermining the Pollyanna principle.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good now here we're getting into like how accurate our perception is, you know, whether our emotions are justified, for you know, like a better word, I guess. I would say that like it's in a way we're sort of fooling ourselves into thinking that life is better by, you know, exploiting how our brains work. But at the same time, if our brains aren't perfect, and this is a very hedonistic argument, I feel, like very utilitarian, like, but yeah, we can just fool ourselves into being happy all of the time, I would say. Because like I said, like even people who are, those who are less privileged, I would say, can definitely be just as almost or on the same level of happiness as someone who is quite privileged. So at the end of the day, like, even though the quality of their lives is markedly different, if they both feel the same amount of pressure and they don't focus on the pain, you know, how do you say that, you know, one life is worse than the other? That how do you say, oh, you know, like maybe these people shouldn't be having kids if they can't provide for them properly? If like happiness is subjective, and you can be happy like under great many circumstances, even if your life isn't great, then yeah, I think that's a big hole in the anti-interest argument.
The last thing I'd want to talk to you about then is an idea I've heard from people who object to antinatalism as sort of counter proposal, which is to say, considering that there is a lens of or at least a small level of subjectivity in the analysis of whether or not antinatalism or whether or not life is suffering and whether or not we should weigh suffering as higher than the pleasure we face, that that should be an individual's decision to make. And the alternative that people propose is free access to euthanasia, where people have the ability to take themselves out. My understanding of this is that this isn't really what antinatalism wants, because I think antinatalists can also support free access to euthanasia on the basis that people who are suffering should be allowed to take themselves out of that suffering. But I think my initial response to the idea of the euthanasia counterproposal is that it doesn't account for the fact that bringing someone into existence in the first place could be an immoral act. What do you think about the counterproposal?
So I believe that free access to euthanasia should be a thing anyway, like regardless of like whatever arguments about antinatalism and... I think free access to euthanasia is a good thing, but I don't think it's a solution to the antinatalist problem. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, like, I'm sure a lot of even like antinatalist philosophers would agree with me that you can't just say, you know, if life isn't good for you, you should just kill yourself. Like, I don't think anyone, I think that the vast majority of antinatalist philosophers would agree that that's not the answer. That, you know, if you don't like life, you should just take us apart. That is not the answer. But answer is, because like I said, the person would have to experience life up to at least, I think, the age of majority to be able to make a decision like that, right? I'm assuming like any such facility, you'd need to be at least like 18 plus something. You'd also probably need like, to give some kind of justification to like some authority or whatever. So yeah, up to that point, the person would have to be alive, would have to suffer. Just because they're a child, you can't, you know, just say, the suffering doesn't matter. You can't just say like the suffering is like the parents' problem to deal with. And the child's problem to deal with, and the child will be fine after, like, you know, they grow up and stuff. after they move out, after they have their own life, like you're asking them to, I would say it's an undue burden you're placing on child. Yeah. Mm. Going back to all the consent arguments and all that. Euthanasia is a lot of some philosophers, like David Benatar, for example, says that life is bad, but like once you experience life, death is worse. So life is like a predicament that you're entering into. It's like a vice squeezing you from both sides. You have birth, your death, and it, you know, squeezing you and putting you into like a problem. And the problem is either you live out your life or you take yourself out of it through death, or you wait for death to come to you. Benatar's opinion, and you know, a lot of other anti-natist opinion, is that you shouldn't enter into this predicament in the first place. You shouldn't have to worry about existing and make the choice of, you know, living or dying. You should just not live in the first place by not being born.
Mm-hmm. So sort of not putting your hand in the vice in the first place.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, I don't think that I think euthanasia is good, but it's not the answer to like problems that antinatism poses.
So I think that sort of wraps up the content we wanted to cover in this podcast. Is there anything else you'd like to go over before we start to wrap things up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was this interesting story. Are you familiar with Ursula K. Le Guin?
I'm sorry?
There's this author. I'm a big fan of Ursula K. Le Guin. She writes sci-fi and stuff. I would highly recommend something like Left Hand of Darkness. But like, for the purpose of this discussion, the ones who walked away from Omelas, it's a short story, and I think it has a lot of like a lot of things to add to like the antinatist argument and the utilitarian arguments. To like, you know, spoilers, but to just break it down, the premise is that there is a town called Omelas, and life there is perfect for everyone. They're all constantly happy. But there is a cellar in this town, like, you know, a basement. And in that basement, there lives a child. She has never seen the light of day. She doesn't get enough to eat. She's malnourished. She doesn't get education. She doesn't get to pay, meet people. Her life is full of suffering. But if anyone in the town helps this child, immediately all the good things that are happening to Omelas, all the happiness that they have, will go away. So in the story, like, a lot of people just like straight up leave the town because they don't want to live with that moral conundrum. I think in a way, like, yeah, that's also a good argument against, you know, utilitarianism, but it's also like a very poignant story for antinatalism. You know, like, is your child going to be the child in the basement or the child playing on the street? Are you going to grow up to be like a healthy, happy adult, or will some, you know, misfortune befall you on the way? I think that's a really good story for anyone to who's interested in this topic to check out. That and the David Benatar's books. I think the latest one is yeah, I think the latest one, I think season 2002, is pretty good.
So then, winding down, wrapping up this podcast, what do you think people should take as their main takeaway from this podcast and discussions about antinatalism more generally?
Let me put it like this. I don't think many people are going to become antinatalists after like listening to one podcast or like reading all these books. Like,
yeah,
I doubt that they're going to get a lot of converts. And even like, I would say, even like, I don't think both of us are like 100% converts either to antinatalism. But I think that I hope people will like become a little bit more aware of like how to about having children and taking care of children. I think you know, I hopefully people will become more aware, like they won't just have kids, they won't make the kids live out their lives. You know, I think that would be a good takeaway to take from this podcast, you know, how to think about pressure, pain, about having children, about finding meaning in life. Like, because I would say life is inherently meaningless, but considering these kinds of questions can help you like figure out what your life is about and what your life isn't about, you know. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's a good takeaway to have, take from this, and of course all the interesting questions it brings up.
I think that's a pretty good takeaway as well. All right, thank you so much, Minesh, for this. It's been a very engaging discussion. I'll give you the floor now for a couple of minutes if you want to plug your work, social media, if you want to, all of that stuff.
Oh yeah, sure. Follow me on Instagram, on Twitter. Twitter is Minesh Isn't. My Instagram is Minesh with 5 H's at the end. I post a lot about like philosophy and politics mostly. Some bit of art as well. So yeah, if you're looking for someone who's into research and philosophy and politics, yeah, give me a follow.
I also very heavily recommend Minesh's Twitter, where he just absolutely takes the mick out of the government. And I think that recent tweet about defense ministry and Paul Sambola was got a lot of retweets. Very fun read, made my day.
Like the government gives me a lot of fodder. Like I can't lie. They might also send me a white van, but you know, those are the times we live in. Mm-hmm. I also post a lot of cat pictures.
Awesome, thank you, Minesh. And for everyone listening, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I don't need to tell you where to find the podcast because you're listening to the podcast, but please follow us on Instagram at PapaDumPhilosophy. Please feel free to rate us 5 stars, give us a thumbs up, whatever it may be. Really helps the podcast out. And honestly, it's just awesome to, you know, see engagement with philosophy content. If you do have any objections to anything we've said on this podcast, that's completely fine. If you have any questions for us, that's also completely fine. Feel free to just drop a DM on Instagram and we'll try to get back to you as fast as possible. And yeah, that is it. Thank you so much for listening and stay inquisitive, everyone. Good night or good day.